I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday. Our guest this hour is the author of What Women Want, An Agenda for the Women's Movement. She looks at, in this very thorough book, an overview of the women's movement, employment issues, the gap in pay and leadership, work-family issues, sex and marriage, reproductive and economic autonomy, women in poverty in this country, and appearance, politics, and strategies for change. Deborah Rohde is our guest, and Deborah is the Ernest W. McFarland Professor of Law and director of the Stanford Center on the Legal Profession. She graduated from Yale University. I didn't realize this. We'll ask her about her early experiences. Yale didn't start accepting women until 1969. Isn't that amazing? She attended Yale Law School. She clerked for Justice Thurgood Marshall. She's a former director of Stanford's Institute for Research on Women and Gender. And her books include Justice and Gender, Speaking of Sex, Gender and Law, Women and Leadership, and The Beauty Bias. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we ask you about the women's movement in the year 2014. Is it stalled? Is there a new wave of a women's movement? What are the issues that need to be addressed? Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Deborah Rohde, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I had no idea Yale didn't admit women until 1969. That seems so late.
They were one of the first of the Ivy Leagues.
Isn't that something? And you were in the second class.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about, this is a great story, it's an appalling story, but the story of the alumni reunion that took place and the guests who were there and the provost's comments about the guests.
Oh, well, yes. William Buckley describes the event. The provost was present while two striptease artists, as he put it, put their hearts into their work. And after they finished, someone asked, "What's the official Yale position toward this?" The provost cast a stern look in their direction and replied, "Yale's position is that the second one is better than the first."
Oh, my gosh. Can you believe that? And that wasn't that long ago. It must have been extraordinarily difficult to be a woman, and there weren't very many in that class, entering this all-male bastion and had been thus for 200 years.
You know, what's surprising to me now is how little of it was surprising to me then.
Really?
It was just how life in college was. And, of course, there were oddities. The women's tennis team on which I played noticed that there were no restrooms or shower facilities for women near the tennis courts. And, you just never had a problem during practice. There was no place to deal with it. Mm. But we were so glad we got court time that no one complained.
Mm-hmm.
And the crew team didn't get showers, and it took a threat of a lawsuit in which a number of very enterprising crew members painted the words Title IX on their backs and called a meeting with the head of the athletic department and invited a New York Times photographer, and at the appropriate moment, they took off their shirts and bared their backs.
Oh, my.
And that picture ran on the front page of the New York Times, and that's how women got showers out at the facility.
Yeah. What about law school, Deborah? Were there other women in Yale's law school?
You know, there were, but I never had a course by a woman professor, and certainly never one that addressed women's issues. Discrimination was everywhere, but in the curricula.
And then you went on to, this is quite a clerkship for Thurgood Marshall, and he had two women out of four clerks. How about that?
He did. Yeah, yeah. And that was astonishing to his colleagues at the time. You know, one woman was pushing the envelope.
Right. Well, you go ahead to 2014, and you write that women are now about half of law students and 30% of full professors are female. So we have, you know, in some sense, when you look at that, there has been progress. When you tell those stories, I'm sure people are aghast. Are you kidding? That was blatant discrimination. Now we have another set of problems, but there are more women in law school.
Right. No, the landscape has totally changed. When I came to Stanford, the then dean, when told I wanted to teach a course on women and law, was horrified. Didn't I realize? He said it would type me as a woman.
Right.
And, I said with what I hoped was faint irony, you know, after all, what are my alternatives? And it's presumably not going to come as a shock to my colleagues. But, of course, his point was academic credibility, and to establish that, I needed a real subject.
Mm-hmm.
And he suggested negotiable instruments. Now, of course, I teach a course on gender law and policy that raises no administrative eyebrows. So you see a completely different landscape.
I don't even know what negotiable instruments means.
They're your checks.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Thank you. I learned something. Let's talk about the term, and you talk about this in the book some. I wonder if we need a term, a feminist, in 2014, what it means to identify as a feminist, and whether or not there's a vast difference between what it was in the 70s and what it is now, if it even exists now.
Yeah, well, it certainly exists, but it's not a term that most women want to associate with. Unless you give them the dictionary definition of feminism as somebody who supports social and economic opportunities for women, then you get 2/3 to 4/5 of women identifying as a feminist. But if you give no dictionary definition, the figure drops to around 1/3.
Hmm.
So it carries a lot of adverse baggage and connotes man-hating, strident, radical, humorless, things that women don't find attractive to associate with.
I found the chapter where you talk about all the women that you interviewed and how much what should be on the agenda in 2014, and whether or not there has been progress made, whether the movement was stalled. You talked to so many interesting women who have been working on women's issues for a long time, and the responses, I thought, were quite interesting. Tell me more about that.
Well, you know, the responses varied in terms of what time frame the women were speaking from.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, about half the women that I talked with thought that we were stalled, and they pointed out that, you know, things like the wage gap haven't significantly improved in the last 10 years. The number of women in top leadership positions, you know, half of women are among management, but only 4% of CEOs, and that figure hasn't significantly budged either. So by a variety of statistics, we're seeing a movement that, if not in total stall, is, as one put it, in hibernation. Whereas others who took the much longer view said, look, this is in the space of a couple generations, we've totally transformed the expectations about gender roles. And the fact that a book like this can even be written and taken seriously is testament to the progress that we've made. And certainly the proliferation of women's rights organizations that are actively involved in pushing the agenda on these issues is a relatively young phenomena. So by those indices, we're making enormous strides.
Mm-hmm. You look,
and
I'm sorry.
People have just a quite different set of expectations about women's roles now than they did when I was growing up.
Let's spend a little bit of time on the pay gap, because you talk about how it's shrunk from 59 cents to 77 cents on the dollar. But it's, as you say, been stalled at 77 cents. And it seems like most people would agree that that just should not be the case, and would wonder why in the world it has been stalled and why we still have that figure. Equal pay, equal work, right?
Right. Well, you know, despite 50 years of experience with legislation guaranteeing equal pay, the pay is by no means equal, and that's because the labor force is gender segregated and gender stratified, with women overrepresented at the bottom and underrepresented at the top. And within every major occupation, women earn less than men, everything from physicians to dishwashers. Even you see a gender gap in earnings. So women tend to be less well represented in elite high-paying occupations. And even when they're represented in the occupation, they're at positions that are significantly lower than men's. So, for example, in law, as you noted, women are half the new entrants to the profession. They're also 86% of paralegals, but they're only 16% of the partners at major law firms, and about the same percentage of general counsel at Fortune 500 companies and law school deans. So at the very top, you see quite a gap.
Mm-hmm. And how much of that, you make mention of this, how much of that is associated with motherhood?
Well, there's a motherhood penalty that's very robust. People, you know, in studies, even controlled studies, people will pay a mother less. And time out of the workforce carries a substantial financial penalty in this country.
I think you write at one point that having children, that motherhood is a greater predictor of wage inequality than gender in the U.S.
Yes. Yes.
That's amazing. And what about women who are in positions of leadership to change some of the very things that you write about? The gap there is enormous, and I don't fully understand that, because there are a lot of women who, if encouraged, probably would run for whatever the positions are, the legislature maybe, or city council, or. But when you look at how many women are representing us in leadership positions, the figures aren't very great, are they?
No, women are over half the voting public, but 18% of Congress and 10% of governors and the mayors of the largest cities. So at 20% of state legislators, and the problem is not so much that women candidates fare worse; it's that women don't run for office, and they don't. Tend to see themselves as viable candidates.
Why?
Well, I think that's a function in part of the socialization process. Women tend to have less confidence in themselves in general for leadership positions. They're less likely to identify themselves as a potential leader. And, you know, that's partly a product of the culture in which we live, in which most of the male role models in leadership positions are male.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the qualities that we associate with leaders, assertive, dominant, and so forth, are masculine. They don't seem attractive qualities in women.
Yeah, they're going back to motherhood and looking at the issue of families. It strikes me, and our children are grown now, but during the years when they were young and working full-time, both mom and dad, holy cow, is that a hard thing to do. I don't think anybody's paying attention to that. And women, I think, have the majority of the work that's involved. Men are more helpful than they used to be, but it's still, you know, going to all the games and going to the school conferences and getting children to a safe place after school and getting them up in the morning. I mean, it's just a whirlwind for so long. I always thought by now that we would have terrific daycare centers in places of business all over this country, that it would be affordable. It is still a real struggle for us to have family-friendly work.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, the United States has one of the least family-friendly policies in the developed world. We're alone with seven other countries in not having paid parental leave. And we do a far less adequate job of providing workplace flexibility, reduced schedules, and access to quality, affordable child care.
Mm-hmm. And why is that? Why is that a peculiarly American thing?
Well, I think there's more resistance in this country to the welfare state, and early on, child care got tagged as you know, socialized child care, and the legislation that would have established a child care system was vetoed by President Nixon on that ground, and we've never come close to getting anything like a comprehensive proposal. And, you know, most states don't even license child care providers, so you need training to be a manicurist, but in all but 12 states, not to be a daycare worker.
Mm-hmm. And then you look at the number of women, and this would be single women who are, huge numbers are in poverty raising children. And that's another whole extreme problem area in this country. How do you raise children successfully and work for not very much money?
Yeah. Well, you know, 1 in 7 women are in poverty.
Wow.
And they pay the price along with their families. And welfare levels come nowhere close to providing subsistence level income in any of the states, and in many there are 50% of what the subsistence in fact costs. So it's just a system that's nowhere close to being adequate to deal with the problem.
We welcome phone calls. We have many of them coming in at the moment. Deborah Rohde is our guest. She is author of What Women Want, An Agenda for the Women's Movement. Her stories are fascinating, of being in the second class at Yale, and do show that there has been progress made. But where are things right now? Why is there still not as much of one, but still a pay gap? She looks at employment issues, at the gap in leadership, inflexible workplace structures. We'll talk more about that. Sex and marriage, hookups with the younger generation. What about cohabitation, divorce, same-sex marriage, reproductive and economic autonomy, women in poverty, appearance and women, politics and strategies for change. And third, we keep hearing this phrase, third wave. What's a third wave feminist? Is there a difference in terms of what the goals are for young women who consider themselves part of a women's movement now compared to years ago? Here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org, our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Deborah is professor of law and director of the Stanford Center on the Legal Profession. She graduated from Yale, attended Yale Law School, and clerked for Justice Thurgood Marshall. Phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now for Deborah Rohde, and we'll start with Jeff in Eau Claire. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Deborah, I called in on a specific issue that I wanted to comment on, but in the meantime, I've been holding on and listening. Very interesting commentary. So I just wanted to add a few quick things. In 1967, there was a prohibition against interracial marriage in Virginia, and in the previous 60s, 15 other states prohibited that. Those things have changed. In 1969, I graduated high school, and then to hear you say that you could not go to Yale until 1969 if you were a woman, that's incredible. But I do believe that that's how much we have changed. My question was specifically about the Equal Rights Amendment, which was a big subject for about 10 or 11 years, and it stimulated people like a young talk show host called Rush Limbaugh to call people feminazis because they objected to some of the rules that were out there. The thing was with the Equal Rights Amendment, even though it was never ratified and it was fought over for 10 years, it was like 56 words. if somebody could read those 56 words, they make perfect sense. Could you comment on the Equal Rights Amendment?
Yes. Well, I think we'll get it when we no longer need it. You know, its impact would be, at this point, mainly symbolic. Most of the concrete things that an Equal Rights Amendment would achieve have already happened through statutes or through judicial opinions. Its main effect would be to strengthen the standard of scrutiny in judicial review cases. And a survey of states with equal rights amendments hasn't found much difference in the way that they protect women's rights than in states that don't have an equal rights amendment. So I think we're talking symbolism here, but symbols are important, and it's shocking that we, unlike most other developed Western countries, don't have a guarantee of gender equality in the Constitution.
Thank you, Jeff, very much for your call. Nancy in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because I'm at home. I'm a nurse who works 3 or 4 days a week, and I'm at home cooking today. My children are grown and gone, and over the last 20 years, I've observed a social environment where it seems that someone has to be, you mentioned earlier, taking the kids to practice, getting them ready for school, being the family manager person. Mm-hmm. And I was that person in our household. And I like that dual role, an adequate provider and a family manager. And I think as we shift and allow men to stay home, I think women will, by necessity and desire, say, I can work longer hours. I can achieve a higher rank in my corporation. But we're still at a place where we raise our eyebrows about men staying home, being a stay-at-home dad, that kind of thing. There's still quite a stigma. At a cocktail party, the assumption is that he can't get a job, not that he's choosing to stay home. And I wonder if we're looking at this inequality and sort of our desire or our thought that we have a desire to have more women in higher leadership roles in our society, we're looking at that sort of head on instead of chipping it away along the sides. If we make a living wage so that either folks could raise a family on one income or one and a half incomes, and then accepted men as stay-at-home folks, I think we may be able to achieve this goal in a roundabout fashion. I don't know. Do you care to comment on that?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Gloria Steinem once said that women will never be equal outside the home until men are equal inside it. And, you know, right now, 1% of full-time caretakers are men. The stigma and social norms just make it very difficult for males to assume that role. And that definitely needs to change. The slogan during the early days of the women's movement, the contemporary women's movement, was that women's liberation was men's liberation, too. And you want a world in which the gender norms are fluid so that it's acceptable for a man who wants to play a greater role in as primary caretaker can do it without social penalties.
But don't you both think that the world has changed so dramatically? I can't imagine too many households being able to have anybody home being a caretaker, that economically it's just not feasible for most families.
Well, that's right. If you want a comfortable standard of living, you need two wage earners.
Right.
Unless one of them is in a very high-paying occupation.
Yeah.
Well, but then isn't that a different problem? Yeah, and I agree with you. I don't disagree. I just think that still identifies another problem.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe
yeah.
Women in leadership need to solve that problem. But
yeah,
we don't see that happening right now.
Yeah, no, it's true. You need broader changes in social and economic policy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you look, and I know that you've done studies of other countries, Deborah. You look at some European countries, and you get a good chunk of time off. If you're a mom with your newborn, you get people helping you in the home. You get fathers have a good long period of time. It's just so much more civilized than America, where you got to go right back to work to prove that you're strong, and you just can't take very much time off, and you got to arrange everything. And it just seems very unnatural for such a huge event in somebody's life.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Well, Nancy, happy. What are you cooking?
Oh, I'm actually making meatballs. They're a lunch item.
Great. Okay.
Well, it's a portable item. It goes in a lunch bag.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks for calling in.
Okay.
Our number is 800-486-8655. I want to talk politics for just a moment here, Deborah, because we're so immersed in these midterm elections. You write that women's votes and issues were front and center in the 2012 election. And I'm just wondering how women's issues have figured into elections, when they have been prominent issues, if there are certain identifiable issues this year where they've been incorporated in campaigns front and center.
Well, certainly, you know, you see a significant gender gap in voting still, and that's been true really for the last 40 years in American politics, and much women are much more likely to identify as Democrats and to support liberal social policies than men are. So women's issues are to some extent, part of the campaigns. But I wouldn't say that in most races they're front and center.
Mm-hmm. What about the vote? What about the importance of the women's vote this year? If you reach a point where you can really sway elections, don't your issues become much more important, no matter if your representative is male or female?
Yeah, you know, I don't think the perception is there that that all women will vote as a block, even on women's issues, such as reproductive rights, which remains a hot-button issue. And certainly the kinds of strategies that my book talks about, making the workplace more friendly, paid parental leave, better protection for equal pay. Those are not major issues in this election cycle.
Mm-hmm. You know, you wonder, don't you, if somebody would take that up as an issue, wouldn't that resonate with so many people? It's amazing that it hasn't been front and center in many a campaign.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to account for the lack of cohesive political support for these issues, given women's majority status in the electorate.
Let's go to, thank you, Nancy, for your call. And let's go to Susan in Racine. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Great.
Good.
Wonderful that you're having this talk on the radio, as it is appropriate during this election time. But I guess I was wanted to further comment on or expand or have you guys expand a little bit on having the focus and what can we do like proactively right now and make the emphasis more on families rather than talking about men and women. Because obviously there's always, you know, with where we are socially right now, you know, the stigma of men being in the home, like you were saying earlier, and the other way around sometimes. But can we put it back onto families and just have it be focused more on families? And this is, I'm asking that your question or this question in regards to like policy change, I guess, at a local, state, and federal level.
Well, I do think it's important to focus on families, but that's not the entire women's agenda. I mean, I think that women also have concerns around access to reproductive services. They have concerns about sexual violence. They have concerns about women's representation in leadership positions. So, you know, families isn't the entire agenda.
Yeah, I know it isn't in regards, but I just mean, I think we could get a lot more done, I guess, I foresee, as far as equal pay, you know, help for maternity leave and all that kind of stuff, I guess is what I'm mostly concentrating on, if we looked at it more like a family issue.
Mm-hmm.
And how, you know, like you said earlier, what is, happens good for women also happen good for men.
Benefits the family. Right. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense, Deborah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for your call. Tina in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. Kind of dovetailing on the previous caller, but not really. I read an alarming report last week in The Guardian that in the United States and England, families are skewed more towards wealthy couples. That the rate of having families amongst middle income and lower middle income, the birth rate is going down. And it's kind of at the point that only wealthy people can afford to have families. They can afford child care, prenatal care, education for their children. And I didn't know, this was last week, but it's just rather alarming, and I kind of see it around me. Like people in their 20s, it's unaffordable to have a family. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a scary thought. If only well-off people will be able to afford to have families. But like your comments. Thank you.
Thanks, Tina. We've certainly been hearing that, Deborah, that for those who are graduating with huge student debt and lack of availability of well-paying jobs, futures are kind of put on hold for a while. Families are put on hold. Getting married is put on hold. Do you see that?
I do see that. But I think it's also important to note that there are a lot of poor women that have families that lack social support, and a lot of women who are facing an unplanned pregnancy, who are poor, lack access to abortions, and so you see a lot of drivers of real social and economic hardship that are a result of failed social policies.
Would you say it's fair to say that women have lost ground on issues like reproductive rights?
Well, there's certainly more contested issues around that right. You know, the pro-life forces have been chipping away at reproductive rights for some considerable period now, and you see a lot of incremental restrictions that are significantly burdening the right to choice.
Thanks, Tina. We'll go back to phone calls in a moment. I want to talk about appearance for a moment, because this may just be, you write in the book about the amount of money that women spend, you know, on diets and on pills to do this and that and clothing and the role of being attractive, and how that you got to be attractive in order to get the best jobs, or if you're less attractive, you get perhaps, if you're a teacher, you write less favorable course evaluations. The role of beauty, of attractiveness, and women having to look pretty darn good. I was over at the, we're across the street from this mall in downtown Milwaukee, and I was going to get a sandwich at noon, and there was a store that had every single pair of shoes in it, had at least, I mean, they were, the heels were so tall, I couldn't even count how many inches they were. And the way that, it, maybe this just is me getting old, but that there's a seems to be a real turn toward wearing very, very high heels, wearing more revealing clothing, younger women particularly. What's that all about?
Well, you know, the sexualization of women is not a new phenomena, and beauty may be only skin deep, but the costs of its pursuit often go far deeper. And, you know, we all know that looks matter, but few of us realize how much, and seldom do we add up the price that we're paying in time, money, and psychological well-being. And just on the shoes issue, I think the single thing that I've written that's gotten the most attention over the course of, you know, a quarter century of writing on women's issues was an op-ed in the New York Times on the subject of women's shoes.
Was it really? What did you write?
Well, I said that they were one of the things that held women back, literally, as well as figuratively, and that the last refuge of true misogynists was in the shoe design industry. And, you know, something like 80% of women's foot and back problems relate to high heels. And an extraordinary number of women suffer as a result of shoes that are functionally designed for anything but comfortable walking.
Mm-hmm. It's weird how...
And that's just symptomatic, a broader set of problems around women's appearance.
Yeah. I've noticed that even with TV shows. I watch a couple shows, not all the time, but feature women as lawyers or women. I was just watching this Madam Secretary show last night for a while. And all the newscasters, you know, in New York, that everybody's into these certain kind of shoes, and they're all high heels, and they're all powerful women. I'm thinking, geez, how can you run? You know, how can you walk fast? You can't, can you?
Well, that was what prompted my my editorial. I was trying to get to a meeting for women in the legal profession, and I was with a couple of other women who were headed to that same meeting who were incapable of walking. And we were in London, and the cab lines were just horrendous, and there was a bomb scare in the subway, so it was closed. And these women were just hobbled by their footwear. And then I began sort of noticing around me how many women were functionally in that position. And I was looking at the London newspapers and their summer shoe sales and just touting up the number of designs that seemed completely non-functional for walking.
Yeah, it's quite a thing, and it persists. Welcoming phone calls, our guest this hour on the Ideas Network is Deborah Rohde, and she is author of What Women Want, An Agenda for the Women's Movement. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Nancy in Rhinelander is next. Hi, Nancy.
I just have a question. And I'm very much for women having equality, but I also feel that having sons and daughters, that there's also got to be equality for men. Right now, my son is not have placement of his son and has to fight for it, and yet we always are giving the children to the women, even though maybe they aren't the best parent. So I understand that, you know, if women want to have equality, they also have to give equality to other people.
Deborah.
Sure, I agree.
Let's go to Linda in Milwaukee. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Hi.
I find this very interesting. It's more of a question and then just an idea. I've noticed that for women of all ages, particularly when you get older, if you watch, like, older programs or even programs now, when people talk to people, parents talk to their children, kid, kiddo, sweetie, hun, honey. And it's very interesting how all people talk to women when they get older and refer them to kind of like children. Mm. And I find that very fascinating because I think older people, I look up to them more than anything with their history and their story. So I think it's rather condescending of all people that do that to people. And then I'm just wondering, are you including single women, older women, or is this just more of a topic of family? Because some people choose not to get married.
They do, and the book certainly talks about that choice, and it should be one that doesn't carry social penalties.
Uh, Linda, thank you very much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is Deborah Rohde. She is author of What Women Want, An Agenda for the Women's Movement, and we're welcoming phone calls. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about sexual abuse and sexual harassment in the workplace. The frequency of the problem, you quote Catherine McKinnon saying that so far as it is known, men sexually harass women as often as they did before sexual harassment was illegal. Is that true?
Well, you know, we don't have really good studies on the frequency because of different definitions and the low frequency with which women report it. Certainly reports of sex harassment have increased, but whether the incidence is any different is hard to pin down.
And what about legal recourse?
Well, you know, certainly we've done a much better job in making remedies available. When I went to school, there wasn't a term. You just had a problem with your professor, and the problem was always yours, never his. There were no complaint channels, and, you know, we didn't even have the vocabulary to discuss the issue. Now, of course, we have the term sexual harassment, and workplaces and educational institutions have complaint procedures that make it much easier for women who are victims of unwanted advances to do something about it.
What about policies? Do you think that most offices in the country do have policies in terms and stated policies, and should they? Do they need to legally of what constitutes sexual harassment? Do they, in terms of firing somebody, talk about what those issues are? Are they important in the workplace?
Yeah, I think they are. And, you know, the number of high-profile lawsuits has really gotten the attention of employers who realize that this is a very costly item. And also, you know, there's increasing awareness of the extent to which it impairs women's work performance.
Let's go to Dempsey in the Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Dempsey.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a stay-at-home father, and I just caught half of the conversation where you mentioned, I believe it was 1% of fathers that stay at home with their children.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
1% of stay-at-home parents are men.
Okay, yeah. I'm completely stay-at-home, and the reason why I'm calling is my wife has her master's, and, you know, we're probably about $120,000 in debt with two children. We have a two-year-old and a seven-month-old. And we make it work. And I stay at home full-time with the children. And I also just picked up two jobs part-time 3 days ago. So, I mean, it is possible, but I am a part of that 1%, and I was hoping that you could mention on how more men could actually accomplish what I'm doing.
Except you're $120,000 in debt, Dempsey. That's a lot. You'll have to dig out of that hole, won't you?
No, we're going to die broke and happy.
But your children will have to foot the bill, right?
More than likely, but, you know, that's on them once they turn 18, right?
Yeah. Okay. Deborah, do you have any response?
Well, you know, no more power to you. I hope the jobs work out.
Yeah. Pepin in Milwaukee. Hi, Pepin.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I, as well, am a stay-at-home dad. We're a lot poorer than all that. One thing I've noticed, and I guess I've started noticing ever since I was a kid, I'm roughly 30 years old now, it seems to me like the right and the whole right to life thing, movement, it's not really so much about morality to me. It seems more of a way to keep people in perpetual economic slavery. You know, when you have generation after generation after generation just statistically not having a lot of education or a lot of workplace opportunities. And, you know, I'd like to see, do you think that that's kind of on the right track, or is it really in their minds about morality?
I think that there's that the vast majority of people who oppose current abortion policies really believe that the fetus is a human being and that it's immoral to kill. So I think that one of the reasons why the debate is so contested and why it's so difficult to find middle ground is that there's not a lot of room for compromise between people who think that it's murder and people who think that it's central to women's liberty and equality.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Pepin, very much for your call. What does third wave feminism mean?
Well, the term has connotes women, young women who've come of age after the gains that were brought by the so-called second wave feminists, those in the 60s and 70s, who really were the founders of the contemporary women's movement. The first wave was the suffrage movement in the late 19th and early 20th century. So it's the young women who are trying to put their issues on the agenda and forge new coalitions, especially among women of color, LGBT women, and those of ethnic status.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at the issues, the new set of issues, are they vastly different than, I mean, what's still on the table from the second wave of feminism that's around now, and what's new?
Well, I think we've recently drawn attention to some longstanding problems. So, for example, rape on campus is one that young women are really
yes.
energized about. And
mm-hmm.
We're starting to see, you know, we've got a president who, for the first time, is on record as supporting the tougher laws and policies regarding campus rape.
Other issues?
Well, you know, I think young women are concerned with workplace inequality, and they're particularly concerned with issues of intersectionality, where race, gender, and ethnicity, and class combine to promote forms of inequality.
And when you look at movements, you talk about this some in the book, is it a mistake for us to look at broad social changes? And the change of the role in women in the 20th century was quite profound. Is it wrong for us to take a shorter view of this, that we need to look at profound social change over the long haul, and that may mean a much longer period of time?
Well, you know, I think you need both perspectives. You know, you need to certainly understand the difficulties of progress on such intractable problems that have been with us for thousands of years. But you also need to, I think, some sense of impatience with the pace of change, and you don't want to be complacent that, you know, the barriers are coming down, women are moving up, and eventually we'll get there, because if we continue at current rates of change, it's going to take a very long time before women achieve equality in executive suites or in the workforce generally.
Thank you so much for being with us, Deborah. Deborah Rohde, our guest, and her book is What Women Want, an Agenda for the Women's Movement. She starts the book by writing about her early years at Yale, where she was in the second group of students, female students, invited to attend Yale University, and that was in 1970. She's professor of law and director of the Stanford Center on the Legal Profession, went to Yale Law School as well, and clerked for Justice Thurgood Marshall. What Women Want is the name of the book, and thanks for all of your calls. Wide-ranging they were and interesting. Tomorrow during this time period, Rick Cleveland will join us. Rick is the writer of the current Netflix political drama House of Cards. He's an award-winning writer and a playwright as well. He was a writer for West Wing. He wrote every episode of 6 Feet Under, and he's written a play the Rep's going to be performing next spring, Five Presidents. So we'll talk about all of his political writing tomorrow during this time period. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing this hour, and KP Whaley on air production.